Please be seated.
I can't tell him off. He's one of the courts team. Right, and it happens to us all. Certainly has happened to me.
All right, good morning. Anything arising overnight?
No, very good. So, just a couple of housekeeping things before we finish with your submissions, Ms. Baker-Galloway. But the first question is, in fact, a question for you. We're just having a look at the schedule for next week, and we can see Ben Farrell's name interspersed with ORAC, and thinking, why? Shouldn't your planner be called after the full case for Fish and Game?
Yeah, ideally, yes.
So this isn't by your design. You're quite happy for him to be slotted, pushed back?
Yes, well, yes, that's right. So the issue that Mr. Farrell's got is his whānau has the cultural harvest TT Islands block, yes, where he's on another island. So we're trying to work around that the best way we can.
Okay.
One option is try and squeeze him in next week. Another option is squeeze him in the week of 12 April in Cromwell.
Sorry?
The 12 April week in Cromwell.
12 April.
Which I know you're trying to keep safe as well, but it's... For the Cromwell people.
And trying to keep safe for the Cromwell people, but how do we look in terms of... how do we look in terms of that week? Well, the only other option, because I think it's all but inevitable that we're back on the last hearing week for Dunedin, because, you know, I see we'll have a reply, is to pop him in there.
And right at the end.
At the end.
Which is which week in May?
That is the 24th.
Yes, he's back. He's back by
he's
then.
He's back. That's what I thought the season would have finished.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. All right. So I think we might pop Mr. Farrell there. It just makes more sense for us to have his evidence following all of the other related evidence, and probably easier for ORAG or territorial authorities, whichever it is, not to have him interspersed with their case.
Mm, that's right.
So that's good. Then other housekeeping things. We released a detailed minute on Wednesday, or the 16th of March, anyway, you know, allowing people to file supplementary evidence, and so certain people file supplementary evidence, and so everybody did, and then indicating all other, you know, everybody else has an opportunity too, but that's to come in on the 26th of March, and that's because we're going to be hearing that evidence in Cromwell. What we didn't do is indicate whether any folk would like to cross, any folk in addition would like to cross-examine, both in relation to Trustpower, Fish and Game and LandPro, that, you know, otherwise hadn't actually given a cross-examination notice, and also cross-examine any other supplementary evidence to be filed by 26th of March. We just need to square that off. It's just a bit of housekeeping, and we'll probably release a minute about that on Monday, just inviting people. I thought the minute looked packed enough, as it was on Tuesday, without losing the whole world, you know, by adding in further direction. So that'll come on Monday, just making sure that everybody who is interested has a chance to respond if they haven't already given an indication that they wish to cross-examine. So that's a job for Monday. All right. Anything else in terms of tidying up, housekeeping, etc., that we need to do, bearing in mind we haven't got a lot of people here who are interested in this? Right. So we're all up to date. Okay, good. Very good. So we're with you now.
Thank you, Mum. So I was up to paragraph 31, I think. Mm-hmm. So this is on the relevant baseline question, which Mr. Page has introduced last week in cross-examination. So if the final form of Plan Change 7 contains a non-complying pathway, or even some sort of discretionary pathway, it's relevant when considering the ability for those pathways to provide for appropriate outcomes to consider how effects will be considered and against what baseline effects will be assessed. And this is a live issue that's currently the subject of an appeal to the High Court by Fish and Game against Judge Jackson's division on Plan Change 5A, which set minimum flows and allocation limits for the Lindis catchment.
Can you, before you move on, because there's a lot of things happening in this room, the salience of which I suspect you understand more quickly than the court will necessarily understand, and maybe that these things are important because they're being raised in Lindis, which, you know, I have no involvement in whatsoever. So what is the baseline? How is that raised, and why?
How is it raised?
I haven't been alert to it. In other words, you are, because I think you probably have a wider knowledge of things happening in Otago, but I haven't heard it.
Okay, so Lindis was quite complicated because it was a hearing of two things. It was Plan Change 5A, but it was also the integrated set of consents to replace all the deemed permits, which it was agreed should be direct referred to the Environment Court so it could catch up. Mm. So we had same set of evidence addressing both decisions, but different. You know, one decision was issued for the plan change, and then 8, 9, 9 were issued for the consents. And the question of, you know, it was the same question that's going to be faced when the land and water plan comes into place. To what level does the river get restored based from its current unallocated state? So the Lindis is one of these rivers that has at least two reaches where the called a losing reach, so the water naturally travels up underground to a certain extent, but that combined with certain levels of abstraction actually left no water on the surface. So the question was, well, how much restoration of surface water flow does there need to be? And from what points do you assess effects compared to what would have been there naturally, compared to what's happened currently, and in between those two extremes? So that was one of the contested issues throughout the hearing, in terms of the legal argument. You know, should we just be looking at what the scale of improvement is from the status quo, which is obviously relevant, it's not irrelevant. So do we look at, you know, current over-allocated state, or what's the level of improvement from that? That's a relevant assessment to get a handle on that magnitude of change. But do we also look at, were there no consents in place, what would this river look like, and what's the scale of effects compared to that baseline?
Your
Ngāti Rangi, aye.
Ngāti Rangi. No consents in place. So if you also look at, if you also assume no consents in place, then what's the question?
Oh, what are the effects of the proposed level of abstraction compared to that naturalised state?
And, you know, in that debate, particularly in the context of Ngāti Rangi, is the question simply one, in terms of the naturalised state, then looking at effects with or without abstraction? Or is the question more complex than that, because, A, speaking for myself here, and I haven't thought about Ngāti Rangi, but I would have thought, that's highly theoretical, that if, even if you return all the water to the river, that you would either get back to a natural state. Mm. In other words, the environment has changed. That's not to say irrevocably changed, but it has changed.
Mm. Well, actually,
the state of environment is a product not only of your taking of water, but your use of water and all of the other activities that are associated with that use.
So that's right.
Didn't seem to me, and I've only read Ngāti Rangi once, and that was in the context, you know, of the day's hearing over a cup of coffee, Ngāti Rangi wasn't responding to the changed environment. It wasn't actually testing the presence of other activities which are also changing the environment and producing effects. So it was highly theoretical. But, you know, maybe that's how things are done down here, that you simply have a model that, you know, looks at a naturalised state of environment and then test the removal of water relative to the physical habitat which is produced, but regardless of everything else which is also happening within
that
physical habitat.
Yeah. So it's all, I mean, fundamentally what it comes down to is water permits and other permits are all for finite terms, these permits that we're talking about. So in terms of what is the existing receiving environment, you can't assume they get renewed on the same basis. Now, there are other things, exactly as you're just saying, around that are relevant to the river and its integration with land and its source to sea flow and so on. There are other elements that don't have a finite term, that are in place, they're permitted, they're legal, they'll endure forever, or they're consented and there's no term that requires their remediation and removal at any point. So that they're permanent. You know, you don't imagine that they've gone away. So we're not imagining a prehistoric river.
No.
We're imagining a river with the flows back into it, but with everything else that's otherwise lawful and permanent.
Well, and you see, even that's a bit bizarre, isn't it? If you imagine the river with its flows restored, that's so highly theoretical it's impossible, because you wouldn't be undertaking those other land use activities without actually the abstraction at the same time.
So it is. Yes.
Daft.
Yes. But I guess it's a matter of trying to anchor a rational comparative point. And like I say, it's not the only relevant comparison, but because we've got the status quo and it is important to understand the degree of improvement. But you might not have read ahead, but where I get to is with this new, this next iteration of Te Mana o Te Wai, and however Otago is going to end up articulating that in terms of the modi of the water bodies and the mana of them, and, you know, the more water you take away from it, the more that's reduced. That's my very basic, you know, summary of it. I think that, in my submission, will also need a meaningful understanding of where would that water have been without abstraction, where would that Māori, what life would that river have supported, where it's still 100% full.
And does that also factor in questions around, and therefore if the water was in the river and the land use activities were not taking place?
Yes, possibly. I haven't thought about even that level of complexity.
Because it is complex, but it's in fact extraordinarily complex. So, yeah, we did hear, I heard, Ngāti Rangi. And anyway, and about the baseline, tell me what you want to say about the baseline. So there is a live issue as to what is your baseline environment.
Well... Yeah, I think it's a live issue for everybody, because when we're talking about the effectiveness of the non-complying pathway, for example, and the alternative limit of no more than minor effects, well, no more than minor compared to what? We all, I think, need to answer that question, because otherwise there'll be arguments about it down the track.
Which is, and hence your thresholds.
So we've got our thresholds, which are no more than minor, which are based on naturalised MELF. So no more than minor compared to what the MELF would be, based on the best available information. Because otherwise, if you don't use something like that, no more than minor compared from what starting point?
From take to take, from mountain to sea, from, I know, I understand the issue. Not sure that... the language of the Act serves us well, though no more than minor effects. What does that even mean? And how then are you meant to calculate that or know that when over even the duration of a plan, the effects may not be manifest within the environment because they're cumulative and they vary across space and time? All right. Anyway, that's something to think about, though.
That's not a good, hard problem for us all.
Very good.
So it's back to a sort of super quick summary of what the High... So the High Court are hearing this in mid-April, if we don't settle, like I keep saying. So Fish and Game are appealing on the basis that the Environment Court applied the wrong legal test in that it rejected the naturalised flow as being the appropriate environmental baseline, i.e. the starting point for effects assessment, instead finding that the current degraded state of the Lindis, the status quo, was the relevant environmental baseline to assess effects on trout and presumably other introduced species. and not the flow that would be in the Lindis were the consents and permits in the catchment not exercised. The Lindis appeal is in the context of the relevant baseline of effects for determining plan provisions. However, in the context of PC7, we are considering what the appropriate baseline will be when consent applications are considered on a case-by-case basis, whether discretionary or non-complying, and in respect of all species in the freshwater ecosystem generally. In Fish and Game submission, the correct existing environment for future activities when there are expiring water permits is as confirmed in the High Court in Ngāti Rangi. In that case, Collins considered when assessing the possible effects on the environment of the proposed consents, was the decision maker required to have regard to the existing scheme or effects on the environment by assessing the environment prior to construction of the scheme? There's up the Raitahi Hydro scheme. Mm. The court confirmed that in the context of water permits that follow the expiry of existing permits, the existing permits of limited duration are not to be considered as part of the receiving environment, rejecting the idea that expiring takes could be construed as being part of the existing environment of the river, and noting that in that case the expired 100-year-old water take permit was not permanent and do not carry existing use right protections. In dismissing the idea that the expiring permit should form part of the existing environment, the High Court observed applying the approach to the circumstances of this case would cut across the sustainable management objectives of the Act. The effect of not following the approach adopted by the Environment Court in Port Gore Marine Farms when assessing the environmental impacts of a proposed consent is to lock in hydroelectricity water takes and flow rates for so long as the controlled activity status is retained, thereby preventing adverse effects from being avoided or mitigated.
No, just pause there and I want to reread that.
Yep. So what, if you go back to read Ngāti Rangi again, what the court did in leading up to that paragraph was look, there is conflicting Environment Court case law, and there's the Port Gore case was about marine farms, and Port Gore said we're assessing effects, imagining these marine farms aren't there anymore because they've got finite terms, but then there's a line of case law that says the other, but the High Court preferred Port Gore.
Yeah, what was the line of case saying the other?
I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
But it's in the paragraphs leading up to Paragraph 63. So this approach is consistent with the High Court ruling in Speargrass Holdings, noting that the concept of environment must reflect reality. The High Court held where a consented activity was likely to be terminated or removed, that activity could sensibly be ignored as part of the existing environment. Then the Environment Court in Sampson and others in Waikato described the rationale for the differing approach to the existing environment in relation to land use consents, which include existing land use consents as part of the existing environment. We're conscious of the distinction between land use consents, which are granted in perpetuity, and water consents, which are granted for a defined term and not necessarily renewed. In relation to the latter, the existing environment must be determined as the environment that might exist if the existing activity to which the water consents relate were discontinued. So Fish and Game submits that Ngāti Rangi and the direction it applies to the appropriate existing environment in respect of the expiry of old water permits is clearly applicable to how effects should be assessed if a discretionary or non-complying consent is applied for under PC7. In the assessment as to whether or not effects are more than minor, including cumulative effects, is on that basis. The Environment Court's Lindis decision appeared to agree with the Ngāti Rangi position on the relevant baseline for all species except for introduced species. And that's for context to show that there was still an application of the Ngāti Rangi principle.
But just for
indigenous species, so that's obviously another part of the appeal to the High Court. That you probably don't need to worry
that's
about.
All right.
But anyway, I'll let you read those two paragraphs.
Okay.
Thank you. And then paragraph 40, plans by virtue of their definition need to be forward-looking. In the context of replacing plans, the Planning Tribunal in Leith and Auckland City Council said, in preparing a district plan under the new regime, the respondent was required to start with a clean sheet and to focus on the purpose stated in section 5. And this was reinforced in the context of the MPS 2011 in Ngāti Kahanunu iwi in Hawke's Bay, noting in respect of water quality provisions in the regional plan, having a sub-optimal present is not an excuse for failing to strive for an optimal or at least close to optimal future. In summary, as far as it relates to this court's consideration of PC7, it's submitted that when considering the application of any policy direction to the assessment of discretionary or non-complying consents, it is to be on the basis that any effects assessment will be against the environment as it would be absent the exercise of existing permits of finite duration. It is also difficult to conceive of how the relevant baseline could otherwise, in the context of the national direction in terms of Te Mana o Te Wai, and the first priority that must be given to the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. It's submitted that the reference point needs to be as close as possible to what the river's original healthy and complete state was in all of the life it originally supported when its moiti was unaffected. Without that reference point, it's submitted that an assessment cannot be made as to the attainment of Te Mana o Te Wai. Fish and Game's statutory function leads it to look at all three priorities of Te Mana o Te Wai in the NPS FM 2020 Objective 2.1. The first priority is obviously relevant, as the attainment of clean and strongly flowing rivers that support abundant and diverse ecosystems are clearly within Fish and Game's statutory mandate. And similarly, priorities 2 and 3 are both relevant to anglers and angling. In the second, well, you're familiar with the second, the recent Southland Land and Water Regional Plan Environment Court decisions have made significant progress in interpreting the local significance in Southland of Te Mana o Te Wai in a statutory planning context. And the quotes below from the first interim decision demonstrate the importance of that concept, albeit in the context of the 2017 version. The recognition of Te Mana o Te Wai is a paradigm shift. Although it has been slow to be introduced to Otago, it must now be a central consideration in water allocation alongside Ki Uta Ki Tai and the protection of the moiti and hauora of water bodies. Fish and Game considers it would be inappropriate, ineffective and inefficient for the implementation and local interpretation of Te Mana o Te Wai to be left to an ad hoc planning by consent approach. The articulation of the three priorities in Te Mana o Te Wai in Otago is at an early stage, and we have one example appended to Ms McIntyre's evidence, which we looked at last week. And even just this early draft, and it's obviously yet to be inputted into by the wider community and tested, gives an indication of how the final version for Otago will, or at least may, likely be fundamentally different to the status quo approach. Not just at this high level, but then in the subsequent recognition of the various values that are important, the freshwater outcomes and objectives for each freshwater body, and the appropriate limits and targets that will be set to achieve those outcomes and objectives. The first priority, at least from Fish and Game's perspective, is clearly heading to restoration of rivers that are restored to flows that support healthy, abundant, resilient ecosystems first and foremost. The second priority focuses on the health of people, as it will be articulated by the Otago community, and potentially those primary contacts people have with water in the way that is both safe and provides for people's well-being. And at the risk of being repetitive, but by way of conclusion, given Fish and Game's and others' experiences leading up to this point, there seems to be no possibility that consents issued on a case-by-case basis would somehow predict the outcome of the land and water plan and properly implement and not otherwise frustrate the ability to achieve Te Mana o Te Wai and Objective 2.1 of the NPS 2020.
All right, thank you. Have you got any questions, Commissioner? No. Any questions? And no questions from me, so we're...
Thank you, Mum.
So I'll move through to your witness.
Call Dr. Hayes. And we've got just a summary for Dr. Hayes to read out.
Sure. firm my evidence.
Do you solemnly swear that you will declare and affirm that in the matter now before the court you speak the truth or truth nothing
but the truth? I do.
So do you confirm your full name is John William Hayes?
I do.
And you've prepared a brief of evidence dated 5 February 2021 and a summary dated 18 March 2021 for the purpose of this hearing?
I have.
And you have the experience and expertise as set out in page 3 and 4 of your February brief?
Yeah, I do.
And subject to corrections, do you confirm that the evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yeah, I confirm.
And where you express your opinion, you hold that opinion based on your experience and expertise?
I do.
So can you just take us through the corrections that you'd like everyone to note and just make sure everyone keeps track of the pages that you're up to?
Okay. On page 14, paragraph 59, last line, the word places should be inserted between galaxids and short term.
Okay, just pause there a second. So that's paragraph 59, is that right?
Yeah, paragraph 59.
59. Can you just tell me what the paragraph commences with, the first five words?
So the paragraph begins, the justification of imposing low flows.
Okay, and we're looking at the last line. So migratory galaxids and their invertebrate food supply is my last line?
Yeah, so it should read migratory galaxids places short-term expediency.
Migratory galaxids.
Sorry, non-migratory galaxids.
So it's just the second line of the paragraph.
Places short-term. So
places short-term.
Yeah, that's right.
Hold on. Short-term, what else?
No, ma'am, I think all. You're looking at the wrong sentence.
Oh, it must be, yeah.
Yeah, it's the second line of the paragraph, which on all our copies is the last line of the page, but maybe your pages are printed out differently.
Yeah, it could have been printed differently.
Okay.
So you just read out the paragraph and then pause and say this is where you want the change to go. So starting with the justification.
Okay. The justification of imposing low flows to control trout to benefit non-migratory galaxids. Mm. Insert places.
I see.
Short term.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
And then it's my page 23 and paragraph 87. There's a subsection D in the list there of bullet points. And in the second line of D, there's a D in parentheses.
Mm.
That should be C. And then on page 29, paragraph 111, in the first sentence, third line, so I'll read the whole line here. So it's methods offering greater certainty in determining effects the higher. And then it says the greater, so delete the greater. 111.
Oh, 111. Okay, which line?
So find the third line and the end of it.
Right, and so instead of...
Yeah, the...
Just repeat it for me.
So it should read... methods offering greater certainty in determining effects... the higher, and then delete the greater.
Right, delete the greater. Okay. Thank you.
So. And then in the same paragraph, fourth line from the bottom of that paragraph, it says flow change, just delete flow. So it should read on percentage change in flow, not percentage flow change in flow. And then on page 31, at the top of that page, there should be a table 2. Mm-hmm. And on the second line of the caption, insert a percentage sign after as. So it should read as percent of mean annual low flow. On page 33, paragraph 122, fifth line from the bottom, there's a minor thing here, just figure 3 should be in parentheses. And I think finally, page 41. Paragraph 147. Second line from the bottom of that paragraph. Trout has been misspelt, so there's tout fishery, should be trout fisheries. A bit pedantic, but...
No. Yeah, as I said to another witness, my eyes self-correct, auto-correct, so that's quite a handy skill.
Sure.
Either that or I can't spot a spelling mistake. No, it's all good.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. So if you could now read out your summary, please.
Variability is a feature of most flow river flow regimes, with flows varying in magnitude and over different timescales. Assessments of the effects of flow alteration on fish and other aquatic life need to be framed within an understanding of the key ecologically important components of variable flow regimes. Resulting environmental flow regimes should be designed to maintain key elements of flow variability to maintain a river's physical and ecological processes, and sufficient base flow to maintain high levels of in-stream habitat and life-supporting capacity. Minimum flows and allocation limits working in conjunction are the policy levers for environmental flow management. Now, there's a section on values and risk-based framework for guiding environmental flow limits setting. In recognition of the continuous nature of relationships between flow and habitat and ecological attributes, and the high uncertainty in quantitatively predicting responses of fish and other life, a values and risk-based framework has commonly been applied in assessing minimum flow and allocation options. The lower the minimum flow and/or the greater the allocation rate, the greater is the risk that life-supporting capacity, ecosystem health, mahika kai, and fishery amenity will be adversely affected. And the more important an in-stream value, the less reduction in flow or modelled habitat and other ecological attributes is acceptable. When there is no information from hydraulic habitat modelling or research on ecological flow responses, minimum flow and allocation limits are usually based on percentage flow alteration, often referenced to the MELF, or the mean annual low flow, which is recognised as an ecologically relevant flow statistic. Now, under the section of defining more than minor effects of flow alteration, I provide below default minimum flow and allocation limits for regional water plans based on the values and risk-based framework. The limits are intended for the test of more than minor effects on life-supporting capacity, ecosystem health, mihika kai and fisheries amenity. The limits set a presumptive standard on the basis it is likely there will be adverse effects over time if abstraction from a river exceeds those limits. The limits are based on percentage of MELF, but the minimum flow limits could also be applied to flow-related habitat and or ecological flow relationships where these have been determined. The limits are also summarised in the table below. Minimum flows or residual flows less than 90% of 7-day MELF and flow allocations of more than 20% of MELF potentially have more than minor effects on life supporting capacity, ecosystem health, mihika kai and fisheries amenity in rivers with mean flows less than 5 cumex. Minimum flows or residual flows less than 80% of 7-day MELF and flow allocations of more than 30% of MELF potentially have more than minor effects on life supporting capacity, ecosystem health, mihika kai and fisheries amenity in rivers with mean flow greater than 5 cumex. If MELF estimates can be made for permanently flowing reaches of intermittent streams, then the minimum flow or residual flow and allocation rate limits I've recommended for small rivers, less than 5 cumex mean flow, could be applied to avoid more than minor in-stream effects. Minimum flow, 90% of 7-day MELF, allocation rate of 20% of MELF, so they're those limits. Decreasing the minimum flow limit to 80% of the MELF could be considered for permanently flowing reaches of intermittent streams that support intrinsic values with no threatened indigenous species and do not provide significant spawning and rearing habitat, juvenile rearing habitat for regionally or nationally important salmonid fisheries downstream. Also, the allocation rate could be increased to 25% of instantaneous flow to take account of the lower in-stream values. When MELF estimates cannot be made for intermittent streams, a pragmatic test of more than minor in-stream effects could be based on instantaneous flow. Cumulative abstraction that alters instantaneous flow at point of take by more than 15% is likely to have more than minor effects on streams that support threatened indigenous species or significant spawning and juvenile rearing habitat for regionally and nationally important salmonid fisheries downstream. In streams that do not support such values, abstraction that alters instantaneous flow at point of take by more than 20% is likely to have more than minor in-stream effects. Information from hydraulic habitat modelling, when available, can contribute to more robust ecological flow assessments and increase the precision of minimum flow limits for protecting in-stream habitat. In these cases, minimum flows or residual flows that retain less than 90% and 80% of habitat available at the 7-day MELF are likely to have more than minor effects on invertebrates and the most flow-demanding fish and rivers with mean flows less than and greater than 5 cumex respectively. An allocation rate that causes flow to be flatlined at a low minimum flow, for example 80% of MELF in small rivers, for weeks to months is likely to have more than minor adverse effects on fish growth and survival. There's a section now on justifying low flows to maintain rare and endangered non-migratory galaxids, which I see as a short-term solution that constrains long-term productivity and resilience of populations. So the justification of imposing low flows to control trout to benefit non-migratory galaxids in Otago streams places short-term expediency before the long-term vision of Te Mana o Te Wai, This potentially comes at a cost to the habitat of non-migratory galaxids and their invertebrate food. There is a difference between a short-term solution to a critical problem, such as the above, and a long-term solution that includes restoration of the health and well-being of the water body and freshwater ecosystem. The long-term conservation goal for these non-migratory galaxid populations should be removal of trout from habitats that are critical for preservation of galaxids, limiting invasion and reinvasion by trout with barriers, and restoration of flows to restore habitat and the productive capacity and resilience of the galaxid populations and other components of a healthy ecosystem. Below that, there's a table summarising the proposed minimum flow and allocation limits for avoiding more than minor flow alteration and effects on habitat, life supporting capacity and ecosystem health. That summarises the text that I've just read out. Is it worth me going through the table? Probably not.
Probably not. I think probably through the questioning, people will draw out from you what they need to understand from that table.
Okay.
Unless it would be helpful for the court, Dr. Hayes, to do that.
We've all studied the table. The court's only got minor questions by way of clarification. I don't need to ask mine now. I can wait for the cross-examination. Commissioner, do you want to ask your questions now?
No. I'm happy to wait for the cross-examination.
We'll go straight to cross-examination. Thank you.
So,
thank you for your summary, Dr. Hayes. And I'll ask you.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I do have some questions about the table, so perhaps we perhaps we'll start there. And in terms of the version of the table that might be most readily available, I'm using the one in your statement of evidence in chief on the one-page summary on page 7. You have that there. Now, there is one slight difference between this version of the table and the version of the table appended to Mr. Farrell's evidence, and that difference relates to the abstraction from permanently flowing reaches of intermittent streams, and there's an additional reference to Schedule 1A catchments that he's inserted. Now, I'm not planning on asking you questions about that just at the moment, so I'm happy to work off this version, but that's the only difference that I see looking at the two tables. Are you aware of any other differences as between what you've recommended and that which Mr. Farrell has recommended?
In Mr. Farrell's table, I thought I saw yesterday that he might have excluded the significant spawning and juvenile rearing habitat for regionally and nationally important salmonid fisheries downstream, but someone needs to clarify that.
Just pause there a second. You think he's excluding what from your summary table at page 7 of your evidence in chief, the significant spawning and juvenile rearing habitat?
I thought I saw that yesterday, but I'm not sure.
I just want to just double check that.
Yes. It seems to be replaced with schedule.
Yeah, you can clarify.
Do you want me to clarify? So schedule 1A in the water plan contains, if we look at it, we'll see exactly what it is, but it does list the important spawning sites, trout habitat sites. So that's why instead of Dr. Hayes' narrative description, we've used the actual schedule in the water plan that records in the context of the water plan where those important habitats are.
Yep. And does this witness agree that's where they are?
Well, I think you can put that to this witness and he'll tell you whether or not he knows.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I will pick that up now then. Do you understand that the Schedule 1A list, the water bodies listed in that schedule, pick up the areas that you're intending to cover in the wording of the table as you have put forward?
Well, I can't say for sure. I haven't looked at it in enough detail recently to know that.
Okay. Right, I want to start with the minimum residual flow row, so the middle row in the table. And I want to start with the minimum flow for abstraction from surface water bodies with a mean flow less than or equal to 5 cumex. And there you recommend that the minimum or the residual flow should be minimum flows or residual flows less than 90% of 7-day mouth. Now, I want to be really clear that I understand precisely what it is that you mean in this box here, because one way of reading this table might say that the minimum flow or a minimum residual flow is any flow less than 90% of the 7-day mouth. So it could be anywhere in that range. Is that what you mean?
No, I know it's somewhat confusing. I see the point you're making. What I was referring to here was that minimum flows less than 90% of mouth could have more than minor effects. So another way of looking at it would be to say that a minimum flow should be no less than 90% of mouth.
That would avoid the ambiguity in the way in which these boxes have been expressed. And what I'm trying to understand is the practical effect of including these thresholds in a policy and how that might be interpreted when it comes to implementation. So you'd accept there's a need for real clarity as to how these thresholds are being expressed if they are to be read as limits in that context?
Yes, I do. And the reason why I used the language in my evidence here was because I was couching it in terms of the test of more than minor. So, but yeah, I agree. In a plan, you'd want to be much more specific in specifying a minimum flow as 90% of the mouth and no less than that.
And presumably that same logic will apply to the way in which the thresholds have been expressed throughout that table.
That's correct.
Staying with the water bodies with a flow less than a mean flow less than or equal to 5 cumex, there you say that the threshold should be set at 90% of the 7-day mouth.
Sorry, so we're about to say you again.
So the minimum residual flow, the middle row, and the first box, or the second box on that row.
Okay, so the middle row and the second box. So, okay, minimum flows or residual flows, 80% of 7-day mouth?
No, box to the left.
One box to the left, okay. First box.
First box, we'll call that one the first box, otherwise all of us will get confused.
Yep.
So I want to understand what's required to calculate the 7-day mouth for a tributary where there's no... there's no historic data, so a tributary of a river where there's no flow recorder. So how do you go about that calculation?
Well, I'm not a hydrologist, so that's who you should direct that question to. I saw in Roddy Henderson's evidence, he talked about things like that, and one method of doing that is modelling mouth, but he said that has a large uncertainty, a high degree of error to it. So the question is best directed to a hydrologist.
So when you've put your thresholds together, you have assumed that they will be capable of being calculated in all of the circumstances or situations where this table might be applied?
Yeah, that's correct, except for the intermittent streams that I talk about where mouth can't be calculated, and then I give an alternative of applying the rules or the limits to instantaneous flow.
We will come to that box in due course, but this table is predicated on an assumption that these figures can be calculated. Is that
that's correct?
Yes. Have you made any inquiries yourself as to the practicalities of calculating these thresholds in the Otago region?
Not directly, but I have been party to meetings where Roddy and other hydrologists have been talking, and I know that it's a considerable challenge.
Is it fair to say there's quite some work to be done in this space based on your understanding?
That's what I understand.
In terms of calculating a 7-day MALF, do you need to be able to calculate a mean annual low flow as well? Is the 7-day MALF a function of mean annual low flow?
So 7-day MALF is a version of MALF. There can also be 1-day MALFs as well. So my understanding with MALF, 7-day MALF, is that for every year of the flow record, you look at the 7 consecutive days that have the lowest flows in that year. You do that for all years and you average those flows across the whole record.
And so with the record, you'd be able to calculate both the 7-day MALF and the mean annual low flow, the MALF. It's the same data set used to produce the different thresholds.
Well, the mean annual low flow and the 7-day MALF, they're the same things. So if I understand your question correctly, we're talking about the same thing, except that one version of the MALF is a 7-day MALF. There's another version. You can have a MALF for any, you could have it based on 1 day, 3 days, 5 days or whatever. They usually concentrate on the 7-day MALF.
I want to stay with the abstraction of water from surface bodies with a mean flow of less than or equal to 5 cumex. So I want to go down the table to the allocation rate. And here you've recommended a threshold of flow allocations of more than 20% of 7-day MALF. Now, just so I've understood that correctly, what you mean there is that an allocation rate of more than 20% would equate to a more than minor effect.
That's correct.
And so you say the allocation block should equate to a size of 20% of the mean annual low flow.
That's so correct.
I've understood that correctly.
That's correct.
Now, when I look at this table, I don't understand whether the allocation rate is supposed to reflect a cumulative allocation rate or a cumulative allocation block from a water body, or whether this is a case-by-case basis. So if consent applicant number one comes along and calculates the size of an allocation block and then lodges an application for the entirety of that allocation block, does that mean that there's no allocation available for consent applicant number two? Or what is it that you have in mind here? Is it the cumulative block size?
It's the cumulative block, yeah.
And where in your table does it reflect that is the case?
Yeah, I don't think it does in here. But I do say in the text somewhere, I think, something about cumulative allocation. But certainly to clarify that table, where I use the word allocation, it should be very clear I'm meaning cumulative allocation, the total allocation.
And when you're referring to the total allocation, are you referring to the total allocation from a tributary or from a tributary in a main stem or from all water bodies within a catchment?
That really depends on the regional council and where they choose to monitor their flows or have a point in a catchment where they are setting their allocation rate and minimum flow. what I intend for how these rules should be used is that the level of protection provided by the minimum flow and allocation rate rule applies right up through the catchment above there, so that, and I say this in my evidence, where you would not want abstraction to be occurring upstream that, for example, in an extreme case would dry the river up, but then still achieve downstream at the point of measurement or monitoring the rules that I've got here.
So where is it, based on reading this table, how is it that the council knows where to measure these things from?
That's up to the council, not me. And that's where all the difficulties of hydrology come in and monitoring the flow.
In your experience, looking at these thresholds, isn't the way that they're incorporated into a regional plan taking it that one step further, where the flow monitoring sites are identified and there's a further level of information as to how those thresholds would be applied?
Sorry, I'm just making a note from the last answer, and I just want you to rerun your question again. If you do so now.
In your experience, when these types of thresholds are reflected in a regional plan, doesn't the regional plan go one step further and identify the flow sites against which thresholds would be assessed?
That's correct. That's what should happen.
Now, you've recommended the importance, and I think it's in your paragraph 49, which is perhaps... the importance of both having a minimum flow and an allocation limit being met. And in your table, you've reflected that by having a row for each of those parameters. I'd like to understand now, I'm going to move two boxes to the right, so the abstraction from the permanently flowing reaches of intermittent streams. And we're going to start with the column containing threatened indigenous species.
So this is box three of the middle row?
Box three in the middle row.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to ask some questions about the box three in the bottom row. And in fact, I'm going to start with box three in the bottom row there, and you have an either method for calculating the allocation rate. So we've talked about some of the difficulties with the way in which the 20% is expressed. I'd like to understand a little more about the 15% of instantaneous flow at point of take if malfestimates cannot be made. So you'd accept that it's simply not going to be possible to estimate MALF in all locations in Otago?
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
And in relation to that difficulty, you recommend a threshold of 15% of the instantaneous flow at the point of take might be the appropriate threshold.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Now, let's say you have 10 applicants stacked up on a tributary. Does each of those applicants take 85% of the instantaneous flow? Is that what you're intending that box to mean?
No, I'm not. I'm not intending that. And I acknowledge the difficulty of implementing a rule like this. I think the ideal scenario again would be to have some point in that stream downstream. Where that rule is applied and that level of protection is maintained all the way up.
So again, dependent on identification of a flow recorder site against which these degrees of change can be assessed.
Yeah, so the other way it might be of doing it is if they can understand the hydrology sufficiently, mainly the way that flow changes up the stream, so it should increase as you go downstream, but you can have losing and gaining reaches. But if that was understood well enough, then it could be possible, I it may be possible, to apportion the takes among users such that this rule would not be broken?
So that would require a more nuanced allocation framework to achieve that outcome?
Yes.
And you wouldn't be able to achieve that on a consent by consent basis, would you?
No, you couldn't.
And the same would apply in relation to the box, if we jump one box to the right, where you've recommended the threshold of 20% of the instantaneous flow point at the take of mouth.
That's correct.
So that's box four?
Yes.
Oh. Box four of the last line?
Yes, that's yep. correct.
I want to understand conceptually the basis on which this table is being put forward, and please tell me if we're straying outside of your area of expertise, and I'll pick this these questions up with another witness. But you understand that this table has been put forward in order to provide thresholds as to when an abstraction from a waterway might have a more than minor adverse effect. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, the cumulative abstraction, yes. Of all the takes in the managed reacher stream, yes.
So I understand from our previous questions that it's the cumulative impact, and I understand now the difficulties with the consent-by-consent basis, but the table, the purpose it's seeking to serve is providing the threshold for what is a more than minor adverse effect.
That's correct.
Is it fair to reflect that by saying that the table serves as a proxy for more than minor adverse effects?
On in-stream life, yes.
Now, you've relied heavily in putting forward these thresholds on the proposed National Environmental Standard on Ecological Flows and Water Levels.
Yes, I have.
And my understanding is that you were a co-author of that document.
I was a co-author of the support document on methods for the draft NES.
And when you think about an environmental flow, the thresholds that you've recommended are dealing with the ecological component of an environmental flow.
That's correct.
And the ecological component is not the only component, is it?
That's correct, it isn't.
And that's reflected in the proposed NES.
That's correct.
Do you have a copy of the proposed NES with you?
I don't have the... I've got the sections from the draft guidelines for the selection of methods, but I don't have the other one, which gives the actual limits.
In the common bundle?
It's not in the bundle.
It's not in the bundle. Okay, all right.
I have some copies to hand up.
Mm-hmm.
I have made an electronic copy available to bring it up onto the screen.
Mm-hmm.
because our printer ran out of toner inconveniently last night. So I'm sorry for my friends. You have a copy. Very good. Come prepared.
All right. Got that for the screen.
Okay. Kathy, I wonder whether that copy could be given to the witness and we'll provide another one to the court when we have some more toner.
Thanks.
Oh, we have another one. Ah, here we go. Do you recognise this document?
Yes.
And this is the proposed National Environmental Standards on Ecological Flows and Water Levels?
Yes.
Do you now produce that as Exhibit Fish and Game 1?
Yes.
By consent. No objections. Exhibit Fish and Game 1. For the record, Exhibit Fish and Game 1 is the proposed National Environmental Standard on Ecological Flows and Water Levels, a discussion document.
So I want to take you to page 7 of the document. You'll see there a heading defining key concepts. That's going to be page 17 of the electronic.
It's page what on the...
It's page 7, but after the Roman
page
numerals.
Seven. Okay.
So we move to... Section 2.2.
Yep.
And you'll see there that the proposed NES seeks to define some key concepts. And there you'll see that the way in which environmental flows and water levels, and that phrase has been used in this document, is to provide for a given set of values which are established through a regional plan or other statutory process. And that paragraph goes on to recognise that environmental flows and water levels may provide for ecological, tangata whenua, cultural, amenity, recreational, landscape, natural character and other values associated with water.
That's correct.
So when we think about an environmental flow regime, the ecological considerations are but a subset of the matters that would need to be considered when establishing an environmental flow regime.
That's correct, because you could include cultural values, you could include recreational values. They were not covered by the ecological flow standards.
And so the thresholds that you've put forward aren't addressing those values?
Not specifically, but they do encompass some of those values, but not directly.
So if we turn over the page, you will see this concept expressed in what I think is a Venn diagram, where there's an intersection in relation to some of the values, but with respect to values, they can extend beyond the flows that might be necessary to sustain an ecological value.
That's a very good point. Yes, I agree.
And this document reflects that challenge and acknowledges what it is seeking to achieve when you move through to section 2.3 on page 9. You'll see at the bottom of that page some bullet points.
Page what again?
Page 9.
Yes, I see.
And there you will see expressed as three distinct elements the requirements for setting of environmental flows and water levels. And the first bullet point picks up on the ecological needs of freshwater systems.
Yes.
The second bullet point then picks up on those other values.
Yes.
And the third point picks up on natural and development values attributed to a water body by Māori and the wider community.
Yes.
And importantly, the last sentence on that page recognises that this proposed NES is only dealing with the first of those bullet points.
That's correct.
Do you accept that additional flows or higher water levels are above the thresholds that you have recommended might be required to sustain some of those other values?
Yes, and a very good example is canoeing.
And cultural values may require more water to be left in a water body?
May well do, yes.
And that's expressly recognised in this NES in section 2.2. So if we go back to page 7, the last sentence on that page
Yes, I agree.
So when we think about the table that's been that has been recommended as a proxy for no more than minor effects, do you accept that it's only really dealing with a subset of the potential adverse effects that might occur in relation to the take of water?
Yes, I agree.
And so significant care would need to be taken when allocating water in accordance with these thresholds, not to preclude the ability for providing for those other values into the future.
Yes, I agree. Very good point.
And so the thresholds that you recommend should not be seen as the thresholds that represent the acceptable or appropriate level of allocation or the abstraction of water into the future in Otago.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to discuss with you now the part of your evidence where you dealt with the issue of justifying low flows to maintain rare and endangered non-migratory galaxids, and this is how you've phrased a short-term solution that constrains long-term productivity and resilience of populations. And in your evidence you recognise that a function of increasing flows might be that access for predatory introduced species such as trout may have an adverse impact on those species to be protected. And is it fair to say that increasing flows will need to take place hand in hand with measures to ensure that effective barriers are in place for trout and salmonid species?
Yes, that approach is essential.
And Plan Change 7 doesn't deal with that, does it? It doesn't contain a mechanism to both increase flows and ensure that those barriers are in place?
I haven't seen anything like that. I can't say for sure that it's not in there.
And so again, real care would need to be taken by doing one of those two elements in the absence of the other.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Lennon.
No questions, Your Honour.
No questions. Forrest and Bird.
Cool, thank you. Your evidence. I just want to pick up on the point that Mr. Moore was making around the non-migratory glasses.
Now, you just have to lift your voice a little bit.
Sorry. So, in your understanding, how long have trout been around in the Otago region? Would it be for more than 100 years?
Well, Salmon and Trout Act of 1867, I think, had just immediately precluded the introduction of trout to the Otago area. So, yes.
Yeah. And over that time, would have there been times where streams which may, for part of the year, have dry reaches, had flows through them that were meant that those dry reaches didn't exist?
Sorry.
I'll reframe that
you
question.
You need to reframe, but again, lift your voice, make it really loud.
Thank you. So we understand that there are some streams that have dry reaches, at least for part of the year, that mean that non-migratory glatsids have a zone where they don't have trout breaching them. But in your understanding of how rivers work, at some point over the last 100 years, there would have been times where those flows through those streams mean that there aren't those dry reaches.
That's correct, yeah. With storms and variable weather patterns, there wouldn't be a stream channel there if water did not flow through it at some point.
And it's feasible that those flows would have enabled species like trout to travel up or down those reaches?
That's correct.
Yeah. And is it feasible to say that those events may occur on a reasonably regular basis?
Yes. Channel-forming floods in most rivers occur like on average once a year, once every 2 years. So relatively frequently you would expect flood flows to go down through channels like that.
Right. So I guess I'm just trying to get to the premise of this assumption that that you cover off in paragraph 14 of your 15 of your summary. That imposing these low flows protects these non-migratory glatsids. In your understanding of freshwater ecology, could there be other reasons why these non-migratory glatsids have survived for such a long period of time in these reaches, other than just the protection from those dry reaches?
Well, for any fish, there has to be the appropriate habitat for them. Most of them have to have some form of cover to hide from predators. That can be from the riparian vegetation overhanging streams and or hiding in among the rocks in the bottom. So they need those prerequisites in order to be there. Diversity of habitats would give populations of non-migratory glatsids more resilience. So they have deep and fast areas. Where you have braided channels, for example, flows sufficient to maintain the braiding and seepage channels, give them refuges in shallow water braids to have refuge from bigger fish predators, including trout, introduced trout and eels. So yeah, it's not just the presence of trout that places pressure on those fish, but make no mistake, trout are a major pressure and implicated in the demise of non-nitrogel exit populations, and they're retreating to refuge areas.
Cool, thank you. In terms of the ability to implement the, your suggested table, are you aware that there are, of rivers where there is sufficient data currently where this, where you could calculate your proposed level of mouths?
There are some rivers in Otago where that can be done now, where there are flow records in main stems particularly, but I don't know enough about the hydrological network of recording in Otago to know how extensively they could apply rules such as I presented through Otago.
Great. And would 6 years be a sufficient period of time to gather additional data for the areas where we may not have it currently?
Certainly, you know, I think from what I understand, there are priority areas already where the demand for water is high and the council is putting a lot of effort into. So you have to triage the issue, the problem, and put your effort into the most critical areas. I think that's what's going on. It may be in 6 years' time, I'm guessing here, that it may be that some streams in Otago still don't have sufficient hydrological understanding to implement these rules. But I would hope that in 6 years' time they would be very close to implementing something like this in all of the major catchments, or the main stems and some of the major tributaries that receive most of the abstraction pressure.
And it would be in your opinion, do you think it would be helpful for the regional council to focus on investing in that recording to enable a better understanding of this over the next period of 6 years?
Well, I hope that they would do that, and my understanding is that they are, but yeah, you'd need to ask the council staff that.
Yeah. I think that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the morning adjournment.
All rise.